Okay, we're on another podcast. I really try very hard to make it different, but every time it comes out the same. So now we've got noises coming in, all sorts of bizarre things. Right, today is Friday the 13th, day after our infamous, I think is probably the right word, elections.
Inauspicious day.
Inauspicious day. I'm here with John Scott, and it's going to be interesting. We've already been talking about the Peak District, as we both, I think, we meet up in various ad hoc places, don't we, just by accident?
Yes.
Because we have similar interests, I think. Yes. I guess. I think that's what it comes with, the Hope Valley, Peak District, and so on.
Yep.
Anyway, so we were talking about, actually, you just, I mean, I'm quite interested in the sort of legacy ideas, and the you mentioned, we were talking about the hotel.
Yes.
Now, I think a lot of people will be interested to hear about where that is.
Yeah, the Rising Sun Hotel near Bamford, it's Friday the 13th. I've just been to our planning committee, which always takes place on a Friday, so it's often Friday the 13th. And the first item on the agenda was the Rising Sun Hotel at Bamford, which has now been empty for somewhere just over 2 years, I think. And we had an application for the site to be redeveloped.
Yeah.
And after a refusal earlier this year, earlier in 2019, they came back with some amended plans for a smaller hotel, which we think architecturally looks good. It will meet the need in the valley for more long-term visitors.
Right.
Because apparently staying visitors spend five times more than your average day visitor.
Right.
And that's one of the things in the Peak District. Or quite unique as a national park. Other national parks, certainly the more isolated ones like the lakes, have a lot more staying visitors.
Yes.
Whereas in the Peak District, because half an hour from Sheffield here, an hour from Manchester, it's very easy to come here for the day and just go home again and not spend much time or much money here. And okay, maybe not everybody wants to spend money, but having more facilities for staying visitors, I think it's a good thing. So the approval of the hotel this morning, I think, was a good decision too. There was a focus on transport, and that was perhaps the biggest issue actually.
Yeah.
How are people going to get there?
Yeah.
How can we do that in a sustainable way? And as we were talking earlier on, Martin, we spoke about climate change, the impacts of climate change, driving, traffic, etc. And that was probably encapsulated in the discussion we had about this hotel. How are people going to get here?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there are stations within a mile at either end, but it's a dark road without continuous pavements. So in practice, are people going to drive to get there? Even if they arrive by train, somehow they've got to get from the stations up to the hotel.
Well, I'm very familiar with the building.
Mm.
I went and had must be about 20 years ago, I had Christmas lunch there.
Yeah. Yes.
It was that sort of place, wasn't it?
It was.
And that is about the only time I ever visited it, despite probably driving past it hundreds of times.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, with some schemes, the sort of things that come up in our conversations with the climate and so on is something like local transport, you know, things like minibuses. And we were thinking about organising site climate events where you'd bus people in from the stations, you know, that sort of idea, you know. So the scale of a hotel that size is, that might be a, you know, like it almost like a bit like, you know, when you do ski resorts.
Well, exactly that. It strikes me that if I was going to run that hotel myself, which I'm not planning to, I'm still planning officer, but if I was going to do that, I would be thinking we should have a minibus which is going to pick our staff, staff as well.
Yes, yeah.
It's going to pick customers up from the station.
Yeah.
Because that will improve the offer, won't it?
Yes.
And as you say, I'm going skiing next month.
Yeah.
I'm not taking my car to France because I'll be picked up at the airport and taken to the resort by, I guess, one of the many organisations or by the company who I'm actually going with.
Yes. And probably in a nice luxury minibus
Well. Yeah.
So you feel like you've been treated, as a guest.
Yeah. I don't know whether you're familiar with the Hope Valley Explorer, which it was launched only this year in the summer months. It's something the National Park was behind. We've been talking about it for a few years. It started off as an idea, it was called the Edale Explorer, but we broadened out the concept to the Hope Valley. And what it is the National Park Authority had some money, a sort of pump priming money, about £30,000 I think it is, that we would put into a scheme which we launched this year.
Yeah.
It ran during the school holidays, so about 6 weeks. It was successful, So it's going to run for the next year. Well, it's a 3-year pilot, so definitely for the next the next 2 years. I went out to tender, and Stagecoach won the tender. And what they do is they run a bus which starts in Chesterfield.
Right.
It drives into the Peak District, and it's got two circuits. The Hope Valley, which includes a loop up to Fairholmes.
Including the Fairholmes. Oh, right over the
Yep.
Right,
and there's an alternative loop which goes up to Edale and back as well.
Right. Okay.
And then at the end of the day, it goes back to Chesterfield with stopping places including Hathersage en route. And what we found is that if we offer that as a visitor experience rather than just another bus being subsidised, if we offer that as a visitor experience with interpretation as we go along,
yes,
it's been really successful.
So would that be 2 or 3 hours, like trip, is that sort of scale?
Yeah.
Or is it?
Yeah. So if you pick it up, certainly if you get the first one out in the morning,
yeah,
it only comes out from Chesterfield once and goes back there once.
Yeah. Okay.
But during the day, it does a loop around Fairholmes, Hope Valley and Edale.
Right.
With a timetable through the villages and up to Castleton.
Right.
It picks up at the stations as well, picks up and drops off at the stations. And it seems like an obvious thing to do, so why hasn't it succeeded in the past? It has been successful. It feels like there's an appetite for people to get out of the car.
Yes.
And
yeah,
it's good for people who don't have access to a car. We're trying to diversify the audience, as it were, in the national park and make the national park more accessible. And this feels like a good way of doing it. So it's been successful this year. The bus companies
are interested. Talking, what sort of size scale are we talking? Bus? Or
it's a normal bus, it isn't a minibus.
So it's like, what, 40 people or something?
Yeah, it's 30-ish,
right.
I think, somewhere around there.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a bit too big to take over Mam Nic. That's one of the problems at the moment.
Right,
it won't go over Mam Nic and down Winnetts,
right,
which would make a real proper circuit.
That would be entertaining.
That would be good. So there is some talk about having a smaller bus that could do that part of
yes.
it and make it a proper circuit. But it's a good example of us. We're trying to respond to the challenges of how do we get people into the national park
yeah.
in a more sustainable way? How do we break people's habit of always doing things in the car? And I think the ticket is £6. It's a hop-on, hop-off.
Right.
And we're talking to other people at the moment. It's only just happened in this last
yes.
few months, I suppose. But we're talking to other people. Seven Trent are interested because of Fairholmes. The National
yeah.
Trust, we think, will be interested because of Longshaw and Upper Padley and so on. And the question is, are there other organisations out there, other businesses, who'd be interested?
So what do you mean in terms of like sponsoring the idea or
yep.
just getting their own clients to, or customers, whatever it might be?
Sponsoring it, because at the moment the National Park is putting money into it, but we can't do that every year.
No.
The idea was to put some pump priming into it.
Gotcha.
But it should become freestanding eventually. And the bus companies should be able to run it commercially, maybe with support from other people in the area, other businesses.
Yes.
That's the thinking.
Okay.
But
right.
it took the National Park to get that thing started.
Yes. Well, I
with
think
some public money.
You know, when an organisation is open to these sort of ideas or any things,
yeah.
it's, you know, when you engage people
yeah.
from
yeah.
all, you know, I mean, just getting people. I mean, I've heard this conversation about the national parks. You know, when you're comparing Northumbria with lakes with the Peak District or Exmoor
yeah.
or something. And then none of them, there's no comparison. I don't understand why they try and make that.
Yes, yeah.
But they do, the one figure that came out to me, I think maybe it was even yourself that we worked when we went to somewhere, and we were talking about £180 per person
yeah.
in the lakes
yeah.
and 35 in the
yeah.
peaks.
Yes, yeah.
So there's a fifth of the
yeah.
revenue or income coming in.
Mm.
But I was recently, my parents are still alive, for example, and they use these U3A.
Yes, yeah.
And they are huge in getting people out and doing, and they're always engaging in new enterprise or something slightly different. So the idea of a coach trip come.
Well, yeah. In fact, the feedback we've had, in particular, I recall seeing the feedback from a fairly elderly couple who said, it's a drive they haven't done for a long time because they can't drive their own car anymore.
Ah, right.
But they were able to get out and use this bus.
Yes.
So it was great for them. It's the first time they've been to Blue John Cavern, which
right.
is underneath Mam Tor for years
right.
because they've not been able to drive there.
Yeah.
So it feels to me like it's an idea that's of its time, because if we think back, I don't know if you recall, but there used to be a bus which went up the Derwent Valley, up past the dams.
Yes,
yeah.
and then up to King's
That's
Street.
Right.
Yeah.
yeah, up to King's Street. That stopped because apparently people weren't using it, which seems surprising. Many years ago, I think I was a student, so it's quite a long time ago, I remember the Goyt Valley had a scheme over in the western part of the national park, yes. where we'd close the valley at a weekend, and there was a bus so people could get in and out.
Yes.
The first thing that happened was the bus stop, because it's quite a short run there, so people, in fact, weren't using the bus. Mm-hmm. They'd park up in the car park and walk or cycle. But that's an idea that it didn't seem to work, because it, I think at the time, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, early 2000s, people were still wedded to the car. Mm. People now, I think now realise that they have to change the habits.
Right.
And if you can provide public transport, there's a bit of an experience too, there's some interpretation. It will, well, it's an idea that I think will work. And it seems to be on a fairly limited experience of 6 weeks of this year. Right. So the idea next year is broaden the season.
Ah, okay.
And broaden the attraction, see if it can go to more places.
So are we talking about one bus a day, or are we talking potentially more than that?
Actually, two buses going around the circuit, having left Chesterfield,
right.
and then go around the circuit several times during the day.
Ah,
off the top of my head, I can't remember how many times it is, but I think I saw the timetable last week. It's probably four, five, six circuits a day.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess that's, that is a roundabout.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Because you mentioned, I mean, the interesting thing about if you're looking at other schemes that work in different environments, something like on the Outer Hebrides or a thing, something comes to mind is actually as a bus service at the same time.
Yes.
Could people hop on and off?
Yeah.
So you can. So you would have people on there all the way around.
Yes, yeah.
And then you have people that just get off.
It was initially going to be called the Hope Valley Hopper, because it's hop on, hop off.
Right.
I think one of the bus companies uses that, so it's a...
It's probably owned, yes,
it's Hope Valley Explorer. but the idea is you buy your ticket and you can get on and off as many times as you like. So you can go for a walk, you can go for a drink and a cafe, and you get back on again.
Yes.
It seems like such an obvious idea.
Yes.
It's one of those you think, well, why hasn't it been done before? I guess the market has been, until now, it's largely been a market for passenger buses serving communities supported by the county council.
Yes.
And the county council has been pulling out of those for years.
Right.
So I think we're trying to fill that gap a little bit.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, this is kind of, you know, where we first met on kind of, you know, this idea of bringing local businesses to be aware of what's going on.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, so when you ask why hasn't it happened before, well, maybe nobody's been asked.
Well, yeah.
I tell you what, the first thing comes to mind when you mentioned that was electric.
Yes.
So an electric bus.
Yeah.
I mean, we've just had this strange and bizarre election.
Mm.
And one of the features that the Lib Dems, for example, they had an electric bus.
Mm.
But somehow it managed to get embroiled in the fact that, you know, without being, it didn't get over that message. And it became, you know, sort of I don't know why it became to the detriment of their message, what it should be doing. Now, electric buses buzzing round.
Well, an electric bus will be the answer here. Perhaps ironically at the moment, but understandably so. The bus company are using a fairly old diesel bus because it's the one that they happen to have.
I'm going to get... I'm going to...
The ambition, from our point of view, is to try and get the service with an electric bus. That seems like the obvious thing to be doing.
Yes. But you've got, this is something like, we're on the outskirts of Sheffield.
Mm.
They're doing a trial, for example, on hydrogen cell cars at the moment. It's those kind of those joined up thinking.
That's right. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm really keen that people. I mean, we're hardly fond of all knowledge, but collectively. That sort of, you know, sort of enterprise, and, you know, a hydrogen cell doesn't have to be electric. I think that, you know, thinking about, and I wouldn't be surprised if that message got out there that you know, these, and they are enterprising, these local companies are, you know, willing to you know, put a banner on a side, electric cells, but just to create something unique.
Yes, yeah.
We're having fun with our electronics today, aren't we, anyway?
And it's interesting, increasingly, and perhaps belatedly, the focus from the National Park Authority is, how does every planning application respond to the climate change challenge? So, again, going back to the Rising Sun application this morning, as proposed, the scheme has got 84 parking spaces, and only two of those at the moment are going to be electric charging points. But with the potential for more, what we're asking is that the scheme includes a cabling, so it can be extended as and when required.
Right.
And the question is, which comes first? If you put the electric charging points in, and have that as one of your USPs or selling points, it isn't unique, is it particularly? Maybe you'll get customers who otherwise wouldn't come. But if you wait for people to say, "I have an electric car, please can I come?" I say, "Oh yes, I'll have to introduce those." So I think at the moment we're asking for two spaces. There was a debate this morning whether it should be four or six.
Mm-hmm.
At parish council, we're asking for four. Friends of the Peak District were saying it should be six.
Yes.
In a sense, it can only go in one direction, that, and I'd like to think the developers, the people who build the hotel, will see which way the market's going and provide more spaces.
Yes.
There's always a question in planning of how far we should push that, how far we facilitate it, and how far we push it.
Right.
And at the moment, we're probably in a facilitation role.
Right.
And there is a view that we should be driving the climate change agenda more.
Yeah.
Than we are, rather than being sort of passive about it, facilitative.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I agree. I think that the problems of any of authority or organisations that. Maybe there are ones afraid to sort of put yourself out there, but the Peak District is such an opportunity. And we live in a world of sound bites, but I could see electric charging points, first hotel, all this sort of stuff,
Well, it's interesting, if you were to Google, I think it's called a Zap Map.
It is. Yes.
If you Google that and see how many charging points there are in the Peak District National Park, very, very few.
Yeah. A big black hole.
There's some down the road here at the hospital in Bakewell.
Oh yes.
And there are some at some holiday accommodation places elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much it. The National Park Authority is looking at introducing them on its own sites. So at the moment, at Alden House, the National Park headquarters here in Bakewell, we're looking at introducing charging points, which will help staff
in this car park
in this car park here now.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Oh, right, okay.
And I'm thinking about doing it at other car parks we own, like Millersdale Station, for example.
Yeah.
If we can get the power out at the right level.
Mm-hmm.
As a National Park Authority, with our obvious concern for the environment, we really should be at the forefront on this.
Yeah. So would you encourage people? I mean, I know lots of, I could name a few things like the Airbnb or the bed and breakfast, they're putting in at their own cost, but they know they're going to get the benefits.
Oh, we absolutely encourage it, because in practice, I think there are very few downsides. If you look at renewable energy, there's always been a real challenge, especially in national parks and other protected landscapes, for example, with wind turbines.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to promote green energy, renewable energy, but how do you do that in a national park if the way you want to do it is through wind turbines?
Right.
Because in themselves they can be a challenge in terms of landscape impact. Solar panels, ground-mounted solar panels, I think less so.
Mm-hmm.
Having solar panels on agricultural buildings, it seems to me like an easy hit, as it were. If you've got a big modern shed, having some solar panels on the roof probably isn't going to make it look any worse. And if it's a dairy unit, an obvious thing to be doing.
Yeah,
I think there's probably a view that we don't like that. So I often say to people, "Have you thought about?" And they say, "Well, I did, but we thought you wouldn't like it." Well, no.
So the perception again.
Yeah, the perception is that we want to encourage.
Right,
It needs to fit in with the character of the area, or if it's a listed building or whatever. But it usually isn't an absolute no. It's about it's about thinking about the design, thinking about what the impact is, thinking about the siting. But electric vehicle charging points, it seems to me, it's a no-brainer.
Yes. I
would encourage it.
Yeah. The source of the power, where that comes from and so on. I mean, I've been involved in visual impact of turbines.
Yeah.
And how much, what are they supplying and so on. Yeah. But you're talking about very small pockets that, these days, the efficiency, and they're getting more and more efficient. Mm. It'd be interesting, a bit like how you've got electric cars, they're leasing batteries rather than buying them.
Yes. Yeah.
So you just replace them now. Mm. Yeah. I'm sure there's something along the lines of, you're not going to be sort of saddled with an old technology.
No.
Like a turbine, for example. They've changed. Literally changing almost month by month in terms of their efficiency.
Oh, they are, yeah.
I remember the old days, you probably know this part of the world, Ilkley and up towards Skipton.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they all installed two-blade turbines, which were incredibly inefficient.
Yes.
They were incredibly noisy,
yeah.
and nobody liked them.
Yeah.
So it set the tone.
Yeah.
well, you know, it's so difficult to sort of undo that.
The latest version of wind turbines are incredibly efficient compared to the previous versions, and with every extra few metres, it's like a logarithmic increase in the power they generate.
Yes.
If it's twice as high, it generates significantly more power. It isn't just twice as much
exponential
power.
Growth
exponential
growth.
That's right. So that's why the offshore ones are particularly good, because they can be very high.
Yes.
Although in themselves, they can be quite intrusive. I'm initially from the northwest coast, Cumbria, and if I go home, I now see off the Morecambe Bay coast, Irish Sea coast, an enormous array.
Because all the way down to Southport, virtually,
And although they're quite intrusive if you don't like those sort of things, if you think about what they're doing, I know a lot of people think wind turbines, actually, I'm okay with those because I know they're doing a good job. But obviously the construction could be quite intrusive out at sea. But,
I just, you know, I didn't realise you're from the lakes, and
Edge of the lakes, Barrow-in-Furness.
Oh, Barrow, right.
Which hasn't quite got the landscape quality of the lakes. It's very close. I was just a joke. Over the slag heap, you can see the lake district.
Yeah, exactly.
Literally.
And the cranes.
The cranes from the shipyard, nuclear submarines, etc.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you can. Yeah. Yes, you can always take that. Yes, it is on the. It is in the foothills. I've been in. But when you think about, I spent a lot of time in Scotland, for example, and the renewable energy argument has been going on for years, and it's been there and everything else. But the one thing I perversely object to is these huge farms on land, out to sea. Yeah. I can do it, but there's driving up the M6.
If you drive up the M6, M74, which is the continuation of the M6,
exactly,
I used to drive that road a lot. Yeah, it's an area that's become, I think, maybe dominated by wind turbines, and to its detriment. There is a place for wind turbines.
I personally
find the area around the M1, M6, A14 junction, which I do quite a lot because I go down to London. There's quite a big cluster around
there is
significant wind turbines. In that landscape, I'm pretty comfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of with you on that little bit, but that bit up the M74.
Yes,
you know, I mean, they've got rid of the application, wasn't it, for the SHAP?
Yes.
And that was mad.
Yeah.
I mean, really was mad in terms of what they were doing. I mean, I understand there is a massive argument. I was involved years ago about the Northumbria, about how they worked with the MOD.
Now,
that's a unique to
to
Cheviot and Northumbria. But it was a massive employer. So instead of being everybody hating the MOD, everybody wanted it. And in the end, they won. But the environmental impact was really, it was a long inquiry.
Otterburn.
I mean, you end up with, I'm talking about tanks.
sat
in the middle now. We don't have that problem.
No, we don't.
But there are, as you talked about earlier, each national park has its unique issues.
That's right.
And it'd be nice to see this idea of just a habit changing. If people's holidays are maybe shorter, or maybe they're more inclined to be, support local. If you encourage people to sort of kind of think about their own environment rather than thinking that they have to go into Lanzarote for a bit of sun. We sat here on the worst day. We seem to have had a continuous month of rain. I don't know about. Were you working? You weren't walking on the weekend of the 1st of December, were you, by any chance?
Oh no, I wasn't. No, but it was. Yeah,
it was absolutely beautiful. We'd invited lots of friends, and we went out. And we had a fabulous day out on Kinder. Now these people, there's one visit, and they've gone back with this amazing impression. And I said, it's not always like that.
It was a beautiful weekend. I remember that well now. In fact, I was out on the Sunday afternoon. It was cold, windy, but very, very fresh and beautiful. I think you're right. We do underestimate sometimes just what we have on our doorstep. I was away in early October. I went to Bhutan on a holiday, a trekking holiday, which was great. And everyone said, that must have been fantastic. I said, yeah, it was. But guess what? When I got back, I had a look around at what I have around me. Obviously, I'm very lucky living and working in the Peak District. And I thought, it's pretty good round here.
Yeah.
And the landscape of Bhutan was special. It was great. It's the foothills of the Himalayas mainly. But it also made me appreciate what we've got here, which I perhaps wasn't expecting. And interesting, Bhutan does sell itself on its environmental credentials.
Yes.
It says it's actually carbon, it's carbon negative in the sense that it's because of their forestry and the way they manage the landscape.
Okay.
They're actually holding on to carbon in a way that other places aren't.
Nice.
They have a lot of hydroelectric schemes. By law, 60 or 70% of the country has to be forested. They have this thing called gross national happiness rather than gross domestic products, with a focus on education, health, and environment.
Right.
And it isn't just a greenwash, it isn't a gimmick, it's...
delivering it. Bhutan's an interesting place. I mean, it's what sort of population are we talking about, Bhutan?
Under a million.
Under a million,
whereas if you go there, you normally fly via Kathmandu, which has a population which is roughly the size of the whole of Bhutan, and is chaotic and dirty and unpolluting. And that shows you in very similar culturally, countries culturally, what could happen.
Yes, yeah. So I do remember, I've been to Kathmandu and it was a long, long time ago, and it was almost medieval.
Yes.
But it's now bonkers.
You wouldn't recognise it.
No.
It's like any Indian city, actually.
It's getting that scale.
It's bonkers and it's worth the experience, but you wouldn't hurry back there particularly. No. So it's a good, but interestingly, I bought some gifts there while I was out there, and they came in recyclable bags. So you didn't get a plastic bag, and yet out on the streets you could barely breathe because of all the air pollution.
So it's
interesting. They obviously decided we don't like plastic bags.
Yeah.
But everything else they're doing to the environment is shocking.
Well, I think it's just an element of small steps, but educating people and we are all human, and whether you're in Bhutan. Bhutan is only, it must be only, what, 15 years since it's opened itself up.
Exactly, yeah, it is. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But I did, when you hear these arguments about travel and stuff, people travel halfway across the world to get to Bhutan, for example.
I was very conscious of that. I thought, my carbon footprint in terms of getting there was something. Yeah. And they're quite privileged. I was quite privileged in a sense to go because they have a minimum charge. It's like a tourist tax,
which
they operate as a minimum charge, and they put that money back into the environment.
Right.
So that eased my conscience slightly of having to fly out there.
But if you take that idea, the scale, I've got a thing about the idea that people can imagine something up to 5 million. This is just a pet thing that we're mucking around with. So the 5 million people, you can see 5 million in your head, and you can, 5 million pounds is scalable, people don't understand, and therefore they can engage with it. And so if we take that 5 million figure, I mean, how many people have we got? Sheffield and Manchester and Nottingham?
Half a million each.
So let's say 2 or 3 million within sort of immediate thing. If you put together a habit changing understanding your own environment, I'm sure you would get people sort of promoting it, and it has that your exponential thing, suddenly it takes off. So we have to hit get to a sort of tipping point.
Yeah.
So maybe some of all these little schemes that we're talking about.
Yeah. Interesting. You mentioned tipping point. It's an interesting phrase that, because we're hearing that increasingly in respect of the increase in global temperatures.
Yes.
We get to a tipping point. But you could also argue that we get to tipping points on behaviour as well, don't we? That suddenly people realise we've got to start behaving differently.
Right.
And it feels to me that whilst we've got the negative of perhaps being at the tipping point in terms of 1.5, 2%,
2 degrees.
we're at that. But maybe we're also at the tipping point. Is it the case we need the burning platform before we change our habits?
Right.
People don't unless they absolutely have to.
Yeah.
It may well be the platform burns from beneath our feet before we get a chance to react. But in the past, we've usually managed to think, it's pretty serious, I'm going to change the way I operate here. That's probably why people get a bit complacent, because something will turn up. We'll sort ourselves out. I was talking to somebody at work just the other day about the hole in the ozone layer, which was a big thing back in the 80s and 90s. Mm-hmm. We don't hear so much about that now. Mm-hmm. So maybe there's a little bit of, we needn't worry, we needn't panic, because, we don't hear about that anymore because we've got rid of CFCs.
Yeah.
This is a bit more serious.
Yeah. Back to scale. That's what I'm understanding. Yeah. I mean, a hole in the ozone layer, over the Antarctic, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And people got that. Yeah. But as that is, things did happen. Mm. but it's been kind of replaced by worse.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do we tack that? Yeah. Or, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right.
And we had haven't mentioned this to you yet. On the 15th of October, the National Park Authority hosted a climate change summit, a climate change conference, effectively, up in Buxton. Had a lot of local businesses, local stakeholders, other authorities, people like Chatsworth were there, big organisations within the national park. And we said, look, it's obvious there's a problem with the climate. We haven't declared a climate change emergency because we thought that could be meaningless if you just declare a climate change emergency in your area, in our case, the national park, and then do nothing, you know,
right.
as if declaring the climate change emergency is enough in itself. So the chair of the National Park Authority, Andrew McCloy, has been very clear he wants us to do something, as opposed to making big gestures.
Right.
So the Climate Change Summit in Buxton, what, 2 months ago effectively, was the first step in that. And we focused on two things, mm-hmm. because again, we need to have a focus, otherwise it becomes a talking shop and nothing happens. So the two things we got people to focus on by having invited speakers and then a workshop session was the impact of transport and the impact of land management, both of which we have some control over as a National Park Authority, but we're not the Transport Authority, so not a lot of that. Through planning, we have a bit of control over land management, but otherwise it's an advisory role to farmers, because essentially farmers can do largely what they want if it doesn't require planning permission and it's not on a triple SI or that sort of thing. So what we did was we had invited speakers to focus on those things. So, for example, greenhouse gas emissions from farming, pretty significant.
Right.
And that's the main land use in the national park. So what can we do about it? And at the NFU are aware that farmers need to do something.
Yes.
So focus on that and focus on transport.
Right.
And we tried to come up with some meaningful actions, often quite small scale stuff, but we have to start somewhere.
So were they corporate invitees, or did you get individual, like the farmers themselves, or was it?
It was mainly representatives. So the NFU were there, the CLA, someone from DEFRA, Natural England, and then big landowners, I think Tissington, Chatsworth, Haddon, etc.
Well, it's going to be this, obviously a conversation like this could go on for an awful long time, but it's interesting. I think it's interesting, and that debate has to happen. We're looking at under the Planet Zulon banner of climate research, and wanting to get business to demonstrate what they do, but actually sort of contribute that, you know, it's part of that message, isn't it, that we go out there that we and people feel better if they can come back to scale and they can then feel as if they're putting something back. I guess it's not the big bad, the world, the big corporate thing. I mean, the corporates, if you want to call it, or company contribution to this. We were just talking about today about sustainable investment, which is kind of not visible, is it?
No.
But then it's something that apparently, according to the facts and figures, you can make significant differences.
Right.
Now, that could be fed back into your local area, But so
when you talk about sustainable investments, what sort of thing do you have in mind?
I'm going to find out. We're doing another podcast specifically of that, so I don't really know very much about it. But we're talking about you asking, the pension funds and so on.
Right. That's
so where do they invest the money, or our money?
In fact, one of the speakers at the event was a fellow called Dan Hurd, and he's, I think, the financial director of some sort at Triodos Bank, which is a Dutch ethical investment bank.
Oh, right. Okay.
And we'd spoken to Dan at another event where he's using something called the Moors for the Future Partnership. It's something which the National Park hosts.
Yes.
It's an organ. Well,
they're based in Edale, aren't they?
Yeah, based in Edale. And the head of that team reports to me in my day job, his day job. But it's a partnership of the National Park Authority, National Trust, the three water companies, RSPB and others. I'll miss some key ones out there: Environment Agency, Natural England, NFU, and the Moorland Association. I think that's pretty much it.
Right.
And the Woodland Trust.
Oh, there you go. Good.
I think they're all the partners. And what we've been doing for the past 15 years is we've been investing in the moors using public money, private money, water company money, to invest in the moors to revegetate it initially, but it's become more than that.
Right.
It's about slowing the flow, it's about carbon capture now.
Yeah.
So we talk about natural capital and all those things which weren't really on the radar 15 years ago, and are very much what the Moors for Future Partnership is about. And what's happening is Triodos Bank and the Moors for the Future Partnership are looking at a pilot where they can look at how we can get investors, as you mentioned earlier, things like pension funds, to invest in the environment. Where's the so if they put money into the environment, where's the return?
Yes. Yeah.
And if they can see, for example, that a water company would pay a farmer or a landowner to do some works on their land in order to reduce the amount of work they have to do at a sewage treatment works down the road, or a water treatment's work, somebody will pay for that.
And I mean, this is the thinking we need, isn't it? The way where people are not treating the problem, they treat the
exactly
how we do. So, and it could be done at very little effort.
Yeah.
It's just a mindset.
Yeah. So. Insurance companies claim if they pay for flood prevention works, as opposed to compensating people for being flooded.
Yeah, there's no
way. It seems like an obvious link, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So that's where we are at the moment. Yeah. And it's something which, if I wouldn't have been talking about 5 years ago, I suspect, because it wasn't on people's radar in quite the way it is now.
Well, I think, the sustainability of any business, or the future proofing of the Peak Parks is like any other. You know, let's get out there and talk, sense to everybody.
Right? Yeah.
Excellent.
Good.
Now then, well, you see, I'll say this once more, and that was 35 plus minutes.
Yes.
And some really nice, interesting stuff will come out of that.
Yeah.
So many thanks, John.
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you,
Martin. That's good. Yeah.